Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we tell you about a nature film that stars a group of monkeys. We will have more on that story later in the program. But first, 150 people were killed when Germanwings Flight 9525 crashed in the French Alps. Officials say the co-pilot flew the airplane directly into a mountain on purpose. Now, experts wonder if possibly removing pilots from planes would improve airline safety. Some suggest, at the very least, letting officials on the ground take control of a plane if a pilot is acting strangely in the cockpit. But airplane industry experts warn that the technology has many problems. And they say the tragic crash of the Germanwings flight was an anomaly, an extremely unlikely event. Each year, more than 3 billion people around the world take about 34 million flights. Fewer than 10 crashes over the past 30 years were purposely caused by commercial airline pilots. The United States military already has pilots operating drone aircraft remotely. The pilots are usually based far away from the drones, even on the other side of the earth. But some experts worry about doing the same for passenger aircraft. Mary Cummings is a former U.S. Navy fighter pilot. She now works as a professor at Duke University in North Carolina. In her words, the real reason a person wants another human in the cockpit is because they want to believe there's somebody in the front who shares their own fate, and thus, if anything goes wrong, they will do everything they can to save their own lives. She and other experts believe cargo planes will be the first aircraft to fly over the U.S. without pilots. They say big cargo companies would go from two pilots to one, with a team of pilots assisting from the ground. Then, all operations would be done by flight specialists on the ground. Most aircraft movements other than takeoff and landing are already automated. They are done with the help of computers and other machines. When pilots want to change a flight path, they program the new directions into the plane's computer instead of making the turns themselves. Aircraft manufacturer Airbus is experimenting with the idea of a windowless cockpit. The company is testing a system of cameras and video monitors that would give pilots a wider, more detailed look at their surroundings. Todd Humphreys teaches aerospace engineering at the University of Texas. He says it would not be hard to go one step further and have the pilots watching those same monitors from a room on the ground. Professor Humphreys argues that pilots on the ground would not have to deal with jet lag or even the dehydration that comes after long flights. In his words, pilots do not often face extreme challenges and might not be able to deal with an emergency if it happens. Instead, he suggests having a team of airplane specialists in the room with all the remote pilots who could assist with any emergency. He says this would reduce the number of mistakes by pilots. But many pilots disagree. They say that often pilots must make split-second decisions. In the end, the final decision may come down to passengers. Are travelers more worried about a pilot killing them or stepping onto a plane without a pilot? You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Monkeys are entertaining. They can swing through trees, hang by their tails, play, dance, kiss, and argue. A new Disney movie captures all of that and more. Katie Weaver has the story.
The nature film Monkey Kingdom stars a group of monkeys that live among the ruins of the ancient city of Polonnaruwa. In Sri Lanka. These small, reddish-colored monkeys are known as toque macaque monkeys. They also follow an established social order. Monkey Kingdom centers on Maya and her newborn, Kip. Maya is low on the social order among the monkeys. She struggles to find food and safety. That struggle increases when she has Kip. Maya is a resourceful monkey. She fights for territory when other troops of monkeys try to invade her living area. The drama and the danger is real. Tina Fey narrated Monkey Kingdom. Reviews say her skills as a comedian add humor to the story. Maya's love interest, Kumar, first appears in the movie jumping strongly and skillfully, while the R&B song What a Man plays in the background. Faye then describes Kumar as 15 pounds of hunky monkey. But Faye also says the monkeys are funny on their own. At one point, Maya is desperate for food. She leads some monkeys on a raid of a human house in the area. They enjoy some birthday cake and steal eggs. The monkeys are far from alone at the Polonnaruwa ruins. There are many kinds of animal neighbors, including leopards and monitor lizards that see the monkeys as a food source. Danger is all around, but most of it comes from the sharp climb Maya makes up the social order. Co-director Mark Linfield said Disney Nature spent almost 3 years filming Monkey Kingdom. He told National Public Radio that shooting the movie was easier than one might think. He said researchers have been studying the monkeys at the ruins for 50 years. He said they were able to explain the animals' behavior and often correctly predict their actions during shooting. Monkey Kingdom is the latest in a series of nature documentaries from Disney Nature. The documentary combines fun with education. It is probably best for children 8 years and older. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. The chief prosecutor in the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland, has announced charges against six police officers in the case of the death of a 25-year-old black man. Freddie Gray died in the hospital April 19th, a week after he was arrested. On Friday, State Attorney Marilyn Mosby said there is probable cause to bring criminal charges against the officers involved in the arrest. She said the state medical examiner's office had ruled that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide. Ms. Mosby said Mr. Gray received a severe neck injury while being transported in a police vehicle after his arrest. She said he was not secured in the vehicle as he should have been. Earlier in the week, police admitted that Mr. Gray had not been secured in the van, an action that violates the department's rules. Charges against the officers include involuntary manslaughter, assault, misconduct, and false imprisonment. The driver of the police vehicle faces second-degree murder and five other charges. Officials, citizen groups, and others continue to work to restore calm to the city. For now, people are not permitted to be outside from 10 o'clock at night to 5 o'clock in the morning. Officials say this curfew will likely last a few more days. The streets have been mostly empty during the curfew, and the city has been mostly calm since the riots on Monday. Thousands of members of the Maryland National Guard and police from Baltimore, the state of Maryland, and other areas are patrolling the streets during the day and at night. Many people have condemned the actions of those who rioted on Monday. But they say that in addition to returning order to the city, officials must deal with the reasons people are angry with police. Gerald Miller lives in Baltimore.
Sure, but it's going to take, you know, people getting involved, getting in the trenches, not just standing behind a, you know, a lecturing or when the cameras is on or whatever. You got to get down here in it with the people. This is where the people are. This is where they're hurting.
People had gathered peacefully for days, demanding to know why Mr. Gray died. The violence began after the funeral for Mr. Gray on Monday. Police say members of criminal groups joined the protesters. They say they did not expect that would happen. Officer Eric Kowalczyk is a spokesman for the Baltimore police. On Tuesday, he told reporters that police were expecting most of those who would gather after the funeral would be students.
When we deployed our officers yesterday, we were deploying for a high school event. I don't think that there's anyone in the country that would expect us to deploy automatic weapons and armored vehicles to an event with 13, 14, and 15-year-olds.
After the violence on Monday, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan declared a state of emergency. He moved his office and his top aides to the city. After the rioting, President Barack Obama said police cannot solve the problems in Baltimore by themselves.
We can't just leave this to the police. I think there are police departments that have to do some soul searching. I think there's some communities that have to do some soul searching. But I think we as a country have to do some soul searching.
The president said rioting is not the same as protesting. And he said those who caused destruction must be punished. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called Athenaïs. It was written by Kate Chopin. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Athenaïs went away one morning to visit her parents, 10 miles back on the Bon Dieu River in Louisiana. She did not return in the evening, and Cazot, her husband, was worried. Cazot expressed his worries to his servant, Félicité, who served him dinner. He ate alone by the light of a coal oil lamp. Félicité stood nearby like a restless shadow.
"Only married 2 months, and she has her head turned already to leave? It is not right," she said.
Cazot shrugged his shoulders. Félicité's opinion of his wife's behavior after 2 months of marriage did not matter to him. He was used to being alone and did not mind a night or two of it. Cazot stood up and walked outside. The night was beginning to deepen and gather black around the groups of trees in the yard. Far away, he could hear the sound of someone playing an accordion. Nearby, a baby was crying. Cazot's horse was waiting, saddled. He still had much farm work to do before bedtime. He did not have time to think about Athenaïs, but he felt her absence like a deep pain. Before he slept that night, Cazot was visited by an image of Athenaïs' pale young face, with its soft lips and sensual eyes. The marriage had been a mistake. He had only to look into her eyes to feel that, to sense her growing dislike of him. But the marriage could not be undone, and he was ready to make the best of it, and expected the same effort from her. These sad thoughts kept Cazot awake far into the night. The moon was shining, and its pale light reached into the room. It was still outside, with no sound except the distant notes of the accordion. Athenaïs did not return the next day, although her husband sent a message to do so through her brother, Monteclin. On the third day, Cazot prepared his horse and went himself in search of her. Athenaïs's parents, the Michets, lived in a large home owned by a trader who lived in town. The house was far too big for their use. Upstairs, the rooms were so large and empty that they were used for parties. A dance at the Michet home and a plate of Madame Michet's gumbo were pleasures not to be missed. Madame Michet was sitting on the porch outside the house. She stood up to greet Cazot. She was short and fat, with a cheery face, but she was clearly tense as Cazot arrived. Monteclin was there, too, but he was not uneasy. He made no effort to hide his dislike of Cazot. "Dirty pig," he said under his breath as Cazot climbed the stairs to the porch. Monteclin disliked Cazot for refusing to lend him money long ago. Now that this man was his sister's husband, he disliked him even more. Michet and his oldest son were away. They both respected Cazot and talked highly of him. Cazot shook hands with Madame Michet, who offered him a chair. Athenaïs had shut herself in her room. "You know, nothing would do last night," Madame Michet said. "Athenaïs just had to stay for a little dance. The boys would not let their sister leave." Cazot shrugged his shoulders to show he knew nothing about last night. "Didn't Monteclin tell you we were going to keep Athenaïs?" she asked. But Monteclin had told him nothing. "And how about the night before?" asked Cazot. "And last night? Do you have dances every night?" Madame Michet laughed and told her son to go tell Athenaïs her husband had arrived. Monteclin did not move. "You know as well as I do that it is no use to tell Athenaïs anything," said Monteclin. "You and Pa have been talking to her since Monday. When Athenaïs said she was not returning to Cazot, she meant it." Two fiery red spots rose to Cazot's cheeks. What Monteclin said was true. Upon arriving home, Athenaïs had announced she was there to stay. It was difficult for her to understand why she had married. Girls were just expected to get married. And she did like Cazot. Monteclin had asked Athenaïs to explain herself. He had asked her if Cazot abused her or if he drank too much. "No," Athenaïs had said. "It is just being married that I hate. I do not like being Mrs. Cazot. I want to be Athenaïs Michet again. I do not like living with a man, all his clothing everywhere, and his ugly bare feet." At the time, Monteclin had been sorry his sister had no serious evidence to use against Cazot. And now there was Cazot himself looking like he wanted to hit Monteclin. Cazot stood up and went inside the house to his wife's room. "Athenaïs, get ready," he said quietly. "It is late and we do not have time to lose." Athenaïs was not prepared for his calm request. She felt a sense of hopelessness about continuing to rebel against the idea of marriage. She gathered her hat and gloves. Then she walked downstairs past her brother and mother, got on her horse, and rode away. Cazot followed behind her. It was late when they reached home. Cazot once more ate dinner alone. Athenaïs sat in her room crying. Athenaïs's parents had hoped that marriage would bring a sense of responsibility so deeply lacking in her character. No one could understand why she so hated her role as wife. Cazot had never spoken angrily to her, or called her names, or failed to give her everything she wanted. His main offense seemed to be that he loved her, and Athenaïs was not a woman to be loved against her will. At breakfast, Athenaïs complained to her husband. "Why did you have to marry me when there were so many other girls to choose from?" she asked. "And it is strange that if you hate my brother so much, why would you marry his sister?" "I do not know what any of them have to do with it," Cazot said. "I married you because I loved you.
I guess I was fooled to think I could make you happy. I do not know what else to do but make the best of a bad deal and shake hands over it. It now seemed to Athenaïs that her brother was the only friend left to her in the world. Her parents had turned from her, and her friends laughed at her. But Monteclin had an idea for securing his sister's freedom. After some thought, Athenaïs agreed to his plan. The next morning, Cazot woke up to find his wife was gone. She had packed her belongings and left in the night. Cazot felt a terrible sense of loss. It was not new. He had felt it for weeks. He realized he had missed his chance for happiness. He could not think of loving any other woman, and could not imagine Athenaïs ever caring for him. He wrote her a letter stating that he did not want her back unless she returned of her own free will. Athenaïs had escaped to the big city of New Orleans. She was staying at a private hotel that Monteclin had chosen and paid to rent for a month. A woman named Sylvie owned the hotel and took good care of Athenaïs. Athenaïs soon became friends with Mr. Gouvernail, who was also staying at the hotel. This friendship helped her feel less lonely about missing her family. But Mr. Gouvernail soon started to fall in love with Athenaïs. He knew she was uninformed, unsatisfied, and strong-willed, but he also suspected that she loved her husband, although she did not know it. Bitter as this belief was, he accepted it. Athenaïs's last week in the city was coming to an end. She had not found a job and was too homesick to stay any longer. Also, she had not been feeling well. She complained in detail about her sickness to Sylvie. Sylvie was very wise, and Athenaïs was very stupid. Sylvie very calmly explained to Athenaïs that she was feeling sick because she was pregnant. Athenaïs sat very still for a long time thinking about this new information. Her whole being was overcome with a wave of happiness. Then she stood up, ready to take action. She had to tell her mother and Cazot. As she thought of him, a whole new sense of life swept over her. She could not wait to return to him. The next day, Athenaïs spent traveling home. When she arrived at Cazot's, he lifted her out of the horse carriage, and they held each other tight. The country night was warm and still, except for a baby crying in the distance. "Listen, Cazot," said Athenaïs, "how Juliet's baby is crying. Poor darling, I wonder what is the matter with it."
You have heard the story Athenaïs by Kate Chopin. Your storyteller was Barbara Klein. This story was adapted and produced by Dana Demange. Listen again next week for another American story in VOA Special English.